that involves such ancient history, and history in another country as well.
Bob, Eleanor began. I think...
No, don't answer that, Ernst yelped. I think you are right. Yes, it would be best if we compartmentalize the information.
Ernst went through the motions of straightening his blotter and the knick-knacks on his desk. Nothing was really out of order to begin with.
How soon you need the information? He finally said.
Now,
Eleanor said.
We'll wait, Harry said.
You realize, of course, I may not come up with anything, especially on short notice.
Of course,
Eleanor said.
Give me the name.
Ernst slid a piece of paper across his blotter. Eleanor wrote Bin's name on it and slid it back. Ernst looked at it a moment and got up without ever touching the paper.
I'll see what I can do,
he said, and left the room. Bosch looked at Eleanor.
Ellie?
Please, I don't allow anybody to call me that. That's why I don't take his calls and don't return them.
You mean until now? You'll owe him now.
If he finds something. And so will you.
I guess I'll have to let him call me Ellie.
She didn't smile. How'd you meet this guy, anyway? She didn't answer. Bosch said, He's probably listening to us right now. He looked around the room, though obviously any listening devices would be hidden. He took out his cigarettes when he saw a black ashtray on the desk.
Please don't smoke,
Eleanor said. Just a half.
I met him once when we were both in Washington. I don't even remember what for now. He was assistant something or other with state back then, too. We had a couple of drinks, that's all. Sometime after that, he transferred out here. When he saw me in the elevator here and found out I was transferred, he started calling.
CIA all the way, right? Or something close.
More or less, I think. It doesn't matter if he gets what we need.
More or less. I knew shitheads like him in the war. No matter how much he tells us today, there will be something more. Guys like that, information is their currency. They never give up everything. Like he said, they compartmentalize everything. They'll get you killed before they tell it all.
Can we stop talking now?
Sure. Ellie.
Bosch passed the time smoking and looking at the empty walls. The guy didn't make much of an effort to make it look like a real office. No flag in the corner, not even a picture of the president. Ernst was back in 20 minutes, and by then Bosch was on his second half-cigarette. As the assistant deputy for trade and development strode to his desk empty-handed, he said,
Detective, would you mind not smoking? I find it very bothersome in a closed room like this.
Bosch stubbed the butt out in the small black bowl on the corner of his desk.
Sorry, he said. I saw the ashtray. I thought,
It's not an ashtray, Detective,
Ernst said in a somber tone.
That is a rice bowl, 3 centuries old. I brought it home with me after my stationing in Vietnam.
You were working on trade and development then, too?
Excuse me, Bob, did you find anything?
Eleanor interjected.
On the name?
It took Ernst a long moment to break his stare away from Bosch.
I found very little, but what I did find may be useful. This man, Bin, is a former Saigon police officer, a captain. Bosch, are you a veteran of the altercation?
You mean the war?
Yeah. Of course you are,
Ernst said.
Then tell me, does this information mean anything to you?
Not a lot. I was in the bush most of my time. Didn't see much of Saigon except the Yankee bars and tattoo parlors. The guy was a police captain. Should it mean something to me?
I suppose not. So let me tell you.
As a captain, Bin ran the police department's vice unit.
Bosch thought about that and said, Okay, he was probably as corrupt as everything else that went with that war.
I don't suppose, coming from in the bush, you knew much about the system, the way things worked in Saigon?
Ernst asked. Why don't you tell us about it? Sounds like that was your department. Mine was just trying to keep alive. Ernst ignored the shot. He chose to ignore Bosch as well. He looked only at Eleanor as he spoke.
It operated quite simply, really, he said. If you dealt in substances, in flesh, gambling, anything on the black market, you were required to pay a local tariff, a tithe to the house, so to speak. That payment kept the local police away. It practically guaranteed your business would not be interrupted, within certain bounds. Your only worry then was the U.S. military police. Of course, they could be paid off as well, I suppose. There was always that rumor. Anyway, this system went on for years, from the very beginning until after the American withdrawal, until, I imagine, April 30th, 1975, the day Saigon fell. Eleanor nodded and waited for him to go on. The major American military involvement lasted longer than a decade. Before that, there was the French. We are talking many, many years of foreign intervention.
Millions, Bosch said.
What's that?
You're talking about millions of dollars in payoffs.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Tens of millions when added up over the years.
And where does Captain Bin fit in?
Eleanor asked.
You see, Ernst said, our information at the time was that the corruption within the Saigon Police Department was orchestrated or controlled by a triad called the Devil's Three. You paid them, or you did not do business. It was that simple. Coincidentally, or rather not coincidentally, the Saigon police had three captains whose domains corresponded, so to speak, quite nicely with the domains of the triad. One captain in charge of vice, one narcotics, one for patrol. Our information is that these three captains were, in fact, the triad.
You keep saying, our information. Is that trade and development's information? Where are you getting this?
Ernst made a movement to straighten things at the top of his desk, and then stared coldly at Bosch.
Detective, you came to me for information. If you want to know where the source is, then you have made a mistake. You've come to the wrong person. You can believe what I tell you or not. It is of no consequence to me.
The two men locked eyes, but said nothing else.
What happened to them?
Eleanor asked.
The members of the triad.
Ernst pulled his eyes away from Bosch and said,
what happened is that after the United States pulled military forces in 1973, the triad source of revenue was largely gone. But like any responsible business entity, they saw it coming and looked to replace it. And our intelligence at the time was that they shifted their position considerably. In the early 70s, they moved from the role of providing protection to narcotics operations in Saigon to actually becoming part of these operations. Through political and military contacts and, of course, police enforcement, they solidified themselves as the brokers for all brown heroin that came out of the highlands and was moved to the United States.
But it didn't last, Bosch said.
Oh, no. Of course not. When Saigon fell in April 1975, they had to get out. They had made millions, an estimated $15 to $18 million American each. It would mean nothing in the new Ho Chi Minh City, and they wouldn't be alive to enjoy it anyway. The triad had to get out, or they'd face the firing squads of the North Vietnamese Army. And they had to get out with their money.
So how'd they do it? Bosch said.
It was dirty money. Money that no Vietnamese police captain could or should have. I suppose they could have wired it to Zurich, but you have to remember you are dealing with the Vietnamese culture. Born of turmoil and distrust. War. These people did not even trust banks in their homeland. And besides, it wasn't money anymore.
What?
Eleanor said, puzzled.
They had been converting all along. Do you know what $18 million looks like? Would probably fill a room. So they found a way to shrink it. At least that's what we believe.
Precious gems, Bosch said.
Diamonds, Ernst said. It is said $18 million worth of the right diamonds would easily fit in two shoeboxes.
And into a safe deposit box, Bosch said.
That could be, but
Please, I don't want to know what I don't need to know.
Bin was one of the captains, Bosch said. Who are the other two?
I am told one of them was named Van Nguyen, and he is believed to be dead. He never left Vietnam. Killed by the other two, or maybe the North Vietnamese army. But he never got out. That was confirmed by our agents in Ho Chi Minh after the fall. The other two did. They came here. And both had passes, arranged through connections and money, I suppose. I can't help you there. There was Bin, who it seems you have found, and the other was Nguyen Tran. He came with Bin. Where they went and what they did here, well, I can't help you with. It's been 15 years. Once they came across, they were no longer our concern.
Why would you allow them to come across?
Who says we did?
You have to realize, Detective Bosch, that much of this information was put together after the fact. Ernst stood up then. That was all the information he would decompartmentalize for today. Bosch didn't want to go back up to the bureau. The information from Ernst was amphetamine in his blood. He wanted to walk. He wanted to talk, to storm. When they got in the elevator, he pushed the button for the lobby and told Eleanor they were going outside. The bureau was like a fishbowl. He wanted a big room. In any investigation, it had always seemed to Bosch, information would come slowly, like sand dropping steadily through the cinched middle of an hourglass. At some point, there was more information in the bottom of the glass, and then the sand in the top seemed to drop faster, until it was cascading through the hole. They were at that point with Meadows, the bank burglary, the whole thing. Things were coming together. They went out through the front lobby and onto the green lawn, where there were 8 U.S. flags and a California state flag flapping lazily on poles posted in a semicircle. There were no protesters on this day. The air was warm and unseasonably humid.
"Do we have to walk out here?" Eleanor asked. "I would rather be upstairs, where we'd be near the phones. You could have a coffee."
"I want to smoke." They walked north toward Wilshire Boulevard. Bosch said, "It's 1975. Saigon is about to go down the sewer. Police Captain Bin pays people to get him and his share of diamonds out. Who he pays, we don't know. But we do know that he gets VIP treatment all the way. Most people took boats out. He flew. 4 days from Saigon to the States. He's accompanied by an American civilian advisor to help smooth things. That's Meadows.
He may have been accompanied," she said. "You forgot the word may there."
"We're not in court. I'm saying it the way I see it might have been, okay? Afterward, if you don't like it, you say it your way." She raised her arms in a hands-off kind of way, and Bosch continued. "So, Meadows and Bin are together. 1975. Meadows is working refugee security or something. See, he's getting out of there, too. He may or may not have known Bin from his old sideline dealing heroin. The chances are he did. He was probably, in effect, working for Bin. Now, he may or may not have known what Bin was carrying with him to the States. Chances are he at least had an idea." Bosch stopped to organize his thoughts, and Eleanor reluctantly took over.
"Bin takes with him his cultural dislike or distrust for putting his money in the hands of bankers. He has an additional problem, too. His money is not kosher. It is undeclared, unknown, and illegal for him to have. He can't declare it or make a normal deposit because this would be noticed and then have to be explained. So he keeps this sizable fortune in the next best thing, a safe deposit vault. Where are we going?"
Bosch didn't answer. He was too consumed by his thoughts. They were at Wilshire. When the walk sign flashed above the crosswalk, they went with the flow of bodies. On the other side of the street, they turned west, walking along the hedges that bordered the veterans' cemetery. Bosch took over the story. "Okay. So Bin's got his share in the safe deposit box. He starts the great American dream as a refugee, only he's a rich refugee. Meantime, Meadows comes back after the war, can't get into the groove of real life, can't beat his habit, and starts capering to feed it. But things aren't as easy as in Saigon. He gets caught, spends some time in stir. He gets out, goes back, gets out, and finally starts blocking some real time on federal raps on a couple of bank jobs. There was an opening in the hedge and a brick walkway. Bosch followed it, and they stood looking at the expanse of the cemetery, the rows of carved stones, a weather-polished white against the sea of grass. The tall hedge buffered the sound from the street. It was suddenly very peaceful.
"It's like a park," Bosch said.
"It's a graveyard," she whispered. "Let's go."
"You don't have to whisper."
"Let's walk around. It's quiet." Eleanor hesitated, but then trailed him as he followed the bricks beneath an oak tree that shaded the graves of a grouping of World War I veterans. She caught up and continued the dialogue.
"So we have Meadows in T.I. Somehow he hears about this place Charlie Company. He gets the ear of the ex-soldier-slash-minister who operates the place, gets his backing, and gets early release from T.I. Now, at Charlie Company, he connects with two old war buddies, or so we assume, Delgado and Franklin. Except there is only one day that all three of them are at Charlie Company at the same time, just one day. Are you telling me they hatched this whole thing on that one day?"
"I don't know," Bosch said. "Could have been, but I doubt it. It might have been planned later after they made that recontact at the farm. The important thing is that we have them together, or in close proximity, in Saigon, 1975. Now we have them together again at Charlie Company. After that, Meadows graduates, takes a few cover jobs until he finishes parole, then he quits and disappears from view."
"Until?"
"Until the Westland burglary. They go in, they hit the boxes until they find Ben's box, or maybe they already know which one was his. They must have followed him to plan the job and find out where he kept whatever was left of his share of the diamonds. We need to go back to the vault records and see if this Frederick B. Isley ever visited at the same time as Ben. I bet we find that he did. He saw which box was Ben's because he was in the vault with him at the same time. Then, during the vault break-in, they hit his box and then all the others, taking everything as camouflage. The genius of it was that they knew Ben couldn't report what was taken from him because it did not exist legally. They knew this. He was perfect. And what made it that way is them taking all the other stuff to cover for the real target, the diamonds."
"The perfect crime," she said, "until Meadows pawned the bracelet with the jade dolphins on it. That gets him killed. Which brings us back to the question we had a few days ago. Why? And another thing that makes no sense. Why, if he had helped loot the vault, was Meadows living in that dump? He was a rich man, not acting like a rich man."
Bosch walked in silence for a while. It was the question he had been formulating an answer to since halfway through the meeting with Ernst. He thought about Meadows' 11-month lease, paid in advance. If he were alive, he would be moving out next week. As they walked through the garden of white stone, it all seemed to fit together. There was no sand left in the top of the hourglass. He finally spoke. "Because the perfect crime was only half over. By pawning the bracelet, he was giving it away too soon, so he had to go, and they had to get that bracelet back." She stopped and looked at him. They were standing on the access road next to the World War II section. Bosch saw that the roots of another old oak had pushed some of the weathered stones out of alignment. They looked like teeth waiting for an orthodontist's hands.
"Explain that to me, what you just said," Eleanor said.
"They hit several of the boxes to cover that all they really wanted was what was in Ben's box, okay?" She nodded. They still weren't walking. "Okay. So in order to keep that cover, what would be the thing to do? Get rid of the stuff from all the other boxes so it would never turn up again. And I don't mean fence it, I mean get rid of it. Destroy it, sink it, bury it for good somewhere it would never be found. Because the minute the first piece of jewelry or old coin or stock certificate turns up and the police find out about it, then they've got a lead and they'll come looking."
"So you think Meadows was killed because he pawned the bracelet?" she said.
"Not quite because of that. There's some other current moving through all of this. Why, if Meadows had a share of Ben's diamonds, would he even bother with a bracelet worth a few thousand bucks? Why would he live the way he lived? Doesn't make sense."
"You're losing me, Harry."
"I'm losing myself. But look at it this way for a minute. Say they, Meadows and the others, knew where both Ben and the other police captain, Nguyen Tran, were,
and where each of them had stashed what was left of the diamonds they had brought over here. Say there were two banks, and the diamonds were in two safe deposit boxes, and say they were going to hit them both. So first they rip off Bin's bank, and now they're going for Tron's. She nodded that she was following along. Bosch felt excitement building. Okay. So these things take time to plan, to put the strategy together, to plan it for a time the bank is closed 3 days in a row, because that's how much time they need to open enough boxes to make it look real. And then there's the time needed to dig the tunnel. He'd forgotten to light a cigarette. He realized now and put one in his mouth, but started talking again before lighting it. You with me? She nodded. He lit the cigarette. Okay. Then, what would be the best thing to do after you have hit the first bank but before the second one is taken down? You lie low and you don't give a goddamn hint away. You get rid of all the stuff taken as cover, all the stuff from the other boxes. You keep nothing, and you sit on the diamonds from Bin's box. You can't start to fence them because it might draw attention to you and spoil the second hit. In fact, Bin probably had feelers out looking for the diamonds. I mean, over the years, he was probably cashing them in piecemeal and was familiar with the gem fencing network. So they had to watch out for him, too.
So Meadows broke the rules, she said. He held something back, the bracelet. His partners found out and whacked him. Then they broke into the pawn shop and stole the bracelet back.
She shook her head, admiring the plan.
The thing would still be perfect if he hadn't done that.
Bosch nodded. They stood there looking at each other, and then around at the grounds of the cemetery. Bosch dropped his cigarette and stepped on it. At the same moment, they looked up the hill and saw the black walls of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
What's that doing there?
She asked. I don't know. It's a replica, half-size, fake marble. I think they move it around the country in case somebody who wants to see it can't make it to D.C. Eleanor's breath caught sharply, and she turned to him.
Harry! This Monday is Memorial Day.
I know. Banks close 2 days, some three. We've got to find Tron. She turned to head back to the bureau. He took a last look at the memorial. The long sheath of false marble with all the names carved into it was embedded in the side of the hill. A man in a gray uniform was sweeping the walkway in front of it. There was a pile of violet flowers from a jacaranda tree. Harry and Eleanor were silent until they were out of the cemetery and walking back across Wilshire toward the federal building. She asked a question Bosch had been turning over in his mind and studying, but had no good answer for.
Why now? Why so long? It's been 15 years.
I don't know. Just might be the right time, that's all. People, things, unseen forces sort of come together from time to time. That's what I believe. Who knows? Maybe Meadows forgot all about Bin and just saw him one day on the street and it all came to him. The perfect plan. Maybe it was someone else's plan, or it really was hatched on that one day the three of them were together at Charlie Company. The whys, you never really know. You just need the hows and the whos.
You know, Harry, if they're out there, or I should say, under there digging a new tunnel, then we have less than 2 days to find them. We have to put some crews underground and look for them.
He thought that putting a crew in the city's tunnels looking for a possible entrance to a bandit tunnel was a long shot. She had told him there were more than 1,500 miles of tunnels under L.A. alone. They might not find the bandit's tunnel if they had a month. The key would be Tron. Find the last police captain, then find his bank. There you find the bandits, and the killers of Billy Meadows and Sharkey. He said, do you think Bin would give Tron to us?
He didn't report his fortune was taken from the vault, so he doesn't seem like the type that's going to tell us about Tron.
Right. I think we should try finding him ourselves before we go to Bin. Let's make Bin the last resort.
I'll start on the computer.
Right. The FBI computer and the computer networks it could access did not divulge the location of Nguyen Tran. Bosch and Wish found no mention of him in DMV, INS, IRS, or Social Security files. There was nothing in the fictitious name filings in the Los Angeles County Recorder's Office, no mention of him in DWP records or the voter or property tax rolls. Bosch called Hector Villabona and confirmed that Tron entered the United States on the same day as Bin, but there was no further record. After 3 hours of staring at the amber letters on the computer screen, Eleanor turned it off.
Nothing, she said. He's using another name, but he hasn't legally changed it, at least in this county. Nobody has the guy.
They sat there, dejected and quiet. Bosch took the last swallow of coffee from a styrofoam cup. It was after 5 and the squad room was deserted. Rourke had gone home after being informed of the latest developments and deciding not to send anyone into the tunnels.
You know how many miles of underground flood control tunnels there are in L.A.?
He had asked.
It's like a freeway system down there. These guys, if they are really down there, could be anywhere. We would be stumbling around in the dark. They'll have the advantage and one of us could get hurt.
Bosch and Wish knew he was right. They gave him no argument and set to work finding Tron. And they had failed.
So now we go to Ben, Bosch said after finishing his coffee.
You think he'll cooperate?
She said.
He'll know that if we want Tron, then we must know about their past, about the diamonds.
I don't know what he'll do, he said. I'll go see him tomorrow. You hungry?
We'll go see him tomorrow, she corrected and smiled. And yes, I'm hungry. Let's get out of here.
They ate at a grill on Broadway in Santa Monica. Eleanor picked the place, and since it was near her apartment, Bosch's spirits were high, and he was relaxed. There was a trio playing in the corner on a wooden stage, but the place's brick walls made the sound harsh and mostly unnotable. Afterward, Harry and Eleanor sat in a comfortable silence while nursing espressos. There was a warmness between them that Bosch felt but couldn't explain to himself. He didn't know this woman who sat across from him. One look at those hard brown eyes told him that. He wanted to get behind them. They had made love, but he wanted to be in love. He wanted her. Always seeming to know his thoughts, she asked,
Are you coming home with me tonight?
Lewis and Clark were on the second level of the parking garage across the street and down a half block from the Broadway bar and grill. Lewis was out of the car and crouched at the guardrail, watching through the camera. Its foot-long lens was steadied on a tripod and pointed at the front door of the restaurant, 100 yards away. He was hoping the lights over the door, by the valet stand, would be enough. He had high-speed film in the camera, but the blinking red dot in the viewfinder was telling him not to take the shot. There still wasn't enough light. He decided he would try anyway. He wanted a hand shot.
You're not going to get it, Clark said from behind him. Not in this light.
Let me do my work. If I don't get it, I don't get it. Who cares?
Irving.
Well, fuck him. He tells us he wants more documentation. He'll get it. I'm only trying to do what the man says.
We should try to go down there by that deli. Get it closer.
Clark shut up and turned around at the sound of footsteps. Lewis kept his eye to the camera, waiting for the shot at the restaurant. The steps belonged to a man in a blue security uniform.
Can I ask what you guys are doing?
The guard asked. Clark badged him and said,
We're on the job.
The guard, a young black man, stepped closer to look at the badge and ID and raised his hand to hold it steady. Clark jerked it up out of his reach.
Don't touch it, bro. Nobody touches my badge.
That's his LAPD. You all check in with Santa Monica PD. They know you're out here.
Who the fuck cares? Just leave us alone.
Clark turned around. When the guard didn't leave, he turned back and said,
Son, you need something.
This garage is my beat, Detective Clark. I can be wherever I want to be. You can get the fuck out of here. I can...
Clark heard the camera shutter close and the sound of the automatic wind. He turned to Lewis, who stood up, smiling.
I got it.
A hand chat, Lewis said as he stood up. They're on the move. Let's go.
Lewis collapsed the telescope legs of the tripod and quickly got in the passenger seat of the gray Caprice they had traded the Black Plymouth for.
See ya, bro,
Clark said to the guard. He got in behind the wheel. The car backed out, forcing the security guard to jump out of the way. Clark looked in the rearview mirror, smiling as he drove toward the exit ramp. He saw the guard talking into a handheld radio.
Talk all you want, buddy boy, he said.
The IAD car pulled up to the exit booth. Clark handed the parking stub and $2 to the man in the booth. He took it, but didn't lift the black and white striped pipe that served as a gate.
Benson said I have to hold you guys here,
the man in the booth said.
What? Who the fuck is Benson? Clark said.
He's the security. He said hold it here a minute.
Just then, both IAD officers saw Bosch and Wish drive by the garage heading up to 4th Street. They were going to lose them. Clark held out his badge to the booth attendant.
We're on the job. Open that goddamn gate, now.
He'll be along. I gotta do what he says, else I'll lose my job.
You open that gate or you're gonna lose it, Peckerwood,
Clark yelled. He put his foot down and revved the engine to show he meant to drive through it.
Why you think we got a pipe instead of a flimsy piece of wood? You go ahead. That pipe will take out your windshield, mister. You do what you want, but he's coming right along.
In the rear view, Clark saw the security guard walking down the ramp. Clark's face was becoming blotchy red with anger. He felt Lewis's hand on his arm.
Cool it, partner,
Lewis said. They were holding hands when they came out of the restaurant. We won't lose them. They're only going to her place. I bet you a week's driving that we'll pick them up there. Clark shook his hand off and let out a long breath. That seemed to bring a more placid tone to his face. He said,
I don't care. I don't fucking like this shit one bit.
On Ocean Park Boulevard, Bosch found a parking space across from Eleanor's building. He pulled in, but made no move to get out of the car. He looked at her, still feeling the glow of a few minutes before, but unsure where they were going with this. She seemed to know this, maybe even feel it herself. She put her hand on top of his and leaned over to kiss him. She whispered,
Come in with me.
He got out and came around to her side. She was already out, and he closed the door. They rounded the front end of the car and then stood next to it, waiting for an approaching car to pass by. The car's high beams were on, and Bosch turned away and looked at Eleanor. So it was she who first noticed the high beams drift toward them.
Harry?
What?
Harry!
Then Bosch turned back to the approaching car and saw the lights. Actually, four beams from two sets of square, side-by-side headlights bearing down on them. In the few seconds that were left, Bosch clearly came to the conclusion that the car was not drifting their way, but rather driving at them. There was no time, yet time seemed to go into suspension. In what seemed to him to be slow motion, Bosch turned to his right, to Eleanor, but she needed no help. In unison, they leapt onto the hood of Bosch's car. He was rolling over her, and they were both tumbling toward the sidewalk when his car lurched violently, and there was a high-pitched keening sound of tearing metal. Bosch saw a shower of blue sparks pass in his peripheral vision. Then he landed on top of Eleanor on the thin strip of sod that was between the curb and the sidewalk. They were safe, Bosch could sense. Scared, but safe for the moment. He came up, gun out, and steadied by both hands. The car that had come after them was not stopping. It was already 50 yards east, heading away and picking up speed. Bosch fired one round that he thought ricocheted off the rear window, the bullet too weak at that distance to penetrate the glass. He heard Eleanor's gun fire twice at his side, but saw no damage to the hit-and-run car. Without a word, they both piled into Bosch's car through the passenger door. Bosch held his breath while he turned the key, but the engine started, and the car squealed away from the curb. Bosch rocked the steering wheel from side to side as he picked up speed. The suspension felt a little loose. He had no idea what the extent of the damage was. When he tried to check the side-view mirror, he saw it was gone. When he turned on the lights, only the passenger side beam worked. The hit-and-run car was at least 5 blocks ahead, near the crest where Ocean Park Boulevard rises and then drops from sight. The lights on the speeding car went out just as it dropped over the hill out of sight. He was heading for Bundy Drive, Bosch thought. From there, a short jog to the 10, and from there, he would be gone and they'd never catch him. Bosch grabbed the radio and called in an officer needs assistance, but he could not provide a description of the car, only the direction of the chase.
He's going for the freeway, Harry, Eleanor yelled. Are you okay?
Yeah. Are you? Did you get a make?
I'm fine. Scared is all. No make. American, I think. Square headlights. No color, just dark. I didn't see the color. We won't catch him if he makes the freeway.
They were heading east on Ocean Park, parallel to the 10, which was about 8 blocks to the north. They approached the top of the crest, and Bosch cut off the one working headlight. As they came over, he saw the unlit form of the hit-and-run car passing through the lighted intersection at Lincoln. Yeah, he was going for Bundy. At Lincoln, Bosch took a left and floored the gas pedal. He put the lights back on, and as the car's speed increased, there was a thumping sound. The front left tire and alignment were damaged.
Where are you going?
Eleanor shouted. I'm going for the freeway first.
Bosch had no sooner said that than the freeway entrance signs came up and the car made a wide, arcing right turn onto the ramp. The tire held up. They sped down the ramp into the traffic.
"How'll we know?"
Eleanor shouted. The noise from the tire was very loud now, almost a continual throbbing.
"I don't know. Look for the square lights."
In 1 minute they were coming up on the Bundy entrance, but Bosch had no idea whether they had beaten the other car or if it was already well ahead of them. A car was coming up the ramp and into the merging lane. The car was white and foreign.
"I don't think so,"
Eleanor called. Bosch gunned it to the floor again and moved ahead. His heart was pounding almost as fast as the tire, half with the excitement of the chase, half with the excitement of still being alive and not broken on the street in front of Eleanor's apartment. He was gripping the steering wheel at the 10 and 2 o'clock positions, urging the car on as if he held the reins of a galloping horse. They were moving through sparse traffic at 90 miles an hour, both of them looking at the front ends of the cars they passed, searching for the 4 square lights or a damaged right side. A half minute later, Bosch's knuckles, as white as bones, wrapped around the wheel, they came upon a maroon Ford going at least 70 in the slow lane. Bosch swung out from behind and passed alongside. Eleanor had her gun in her hands, but was holding it below the window so it could not be seen from outside the car. The white male driver didn't even look over or register notice. As they pulled ahead, Eleanor shouted,
"Square lights! Side by side!"
"Is it the car?" Bosch called back excitedly.
"I can't... I don't know! Can't see the right side for damage. It could be. The guy isn't showing anything."
They were 3/4 of a car length ahead now. Bosch grabbed the portable pullover light off the transmission hump on the floor and swung it out the window onto the roof. He switched on the revolving blue light and slowly began to angle the Ford onto the shoulder. Eleanor put her hand out the window and signaled the car over. The driver began to comply. Bosch braked sharply and let the other car shoot by onto the shoulder. Then Bosch swung his car onto the shoulder behind it. When both had stopped alongside a sound barrier wall, Bosch realized he had a big problem. He put on the high beams, but still, only the passenger side headlight responded. The car in front was too close to the wall for Bosch and Wish to see if the right side was damaged. Meantime, the driver sat in his car, mostly shrouded in darkness.
"Shit," Bosch said. "Okay, don't come up till I say it's clear, okay?"
"Got it," she said.
Bosch had to throw his weight hard against the door to open it. He came out of the car, gun in one hand and flashlight in the other. He held the light out away from his body and trained its beam on the driver of the car ahead. The roar of passing traffic in his ears, Bosch started to shout, but a diesel horn drowned him out and a blast of wind from the passing semi shoved him forward. Bosch tried again, shouting for the driver to stick both hands out the side window where Bosch could see them. Nothing. Bosch shouted the order again. After a long moment, with Bosch poised off the left rear fender of the maroon car, the driver finally complied. Bosch ran the flashbeam through the back window and saw no other occupants. He ran up and put the light on the driver and ordered him to step out slowly.
"What is this?"
the man protested. He was small, with pale skin, reddish hair, and a transparent mustache. He opened the car door and stepped out with his hands up. He was wearing a white button-down shirt and beige pants held up by suspenders. He looked out into the passing field of cars, almost as if beckoning for a witness to this commuter's nightmare.
Can I see a badge?" he stammered.
Bosch rushed forward, spun him around, and slammed his body into the side of his car, his head and shoulders over its roof. With one hand on the back of the man's neck, holding him down, and the other holding the gun to his ear, Bosch shouted to Eleanor that it was clear.
"Check the front side!"
The man beneath Bosch let out a moaning sound like a scared animal, and Bosch could feel him shaking. His neck felt clammy. Bosch never took his eyes off him to see where Eleanor was. Suddenly, her voice was right behind him.
"Let him go," she said. "It's not him. There's no damage. We've got the wrong car."
Part 6. Friday, May 25th. They were interviewed by the Santa Monica police, the California Highway Patrol, LAPD, and the FBI. A DUI unit had been called to give Bosch a sobriety test. He passed. And by 2 a.m., he sat in an interview room at the West Los Angeles Bureau, bone-tired and wondering if the Coast Guard or IRS would be next. He and Eleanor had been separated, and he hadn't seen her since they had arrived 3 hours earlier. It bothered him that he could not be with her to protect her from the interrogators. Lieutenant Harvey, 98 pounds, came into the room then and told Bosch they were finished for the night. Bosch could tell that 98 was angry, and it wasn't just because he had been rousted from home. What kind of cop doesn't get the make of the car that tries to run him down? He asked. Bosch was used to the second-guessing tone to the questions. It had been that way all night. Like I told every one of those guys before you, I was a little busy at the time. I was trying to save my ass. And this guy you pull over, Pounds cut in, Jesus, Bosch, you rough him up on the side of the freeway? Every asshole with a car phone is dialing 911 reporting kidnap, murder, who knows what else. Couldn't you have tried to get a look at the right side of his car before you pulled him over? It was impossible. All of this is covered in the report we typed up, Lieutenant. I've gone over it, seems like 10 times already. Pounds acted as though he didn't hear. And he's a lawyer, no less. So what? Bosch said, now losing his patience. We apologized. It was a mistake. The car looked the same. And if he's going to sue somebody or anybody, it'll be the FBI. They've got deeper pockets, so don't worry about it. No, he'll sue us both. He's already talking about it, for Christ's sake. And this is not the time to try to be funny, Bosch. It's also not the time to be worried about what we did or didn't do right. None of the suits that have come in here to interview me have seemed to care that somebody might be trying to kill us. They just want to know how far away I was when I fired, and whether I endangered bystanders, and why I pulled that car over without probable cause. Well, fuck it, man. Somebody is out to kill my partner and me. Excuse me if I'm not feeling particularly sorry for the lawyer who got his suspenders twisted. Pounds was ready for that argument. Bosch, for all we have evidence of, it could have just been a drunk. And what do you mean, partner? You are on a day-to-day loan to this investigation, and after tonight, I think the loan is going to be withdrawn. You've spent 5 solid days on this case, and from what I understand from Rourke, you've got nothing. It was no drunk, Pounds. We were a target, and I don't care what Rourke says we have. I'm going to clear this one. And if you'd quit undermining the effort, believe in your own people for once, and maybe get those internal affairs assholes off me, you might be in line for a piece of the honors when it happens. Pounds' eyebrows arched like roller coasters. Yeah, I know about Lewis and Clark, Bosch said. And I know their paper was being copied to you. I guess they didn't tell you about the little talk we had. I caught him snoozing outside my house. It was clear from his expression that Pounds had not heard. Lewis and Clark were staying low, and Bosch would not get jammed up over what he had done to them. He began to wonder where the 2 IAD detectives had been when he and Eleanor had almost been run down. Meanwhile, Pounds remained silent for a long time. He was a fish swimming around the bait Bosch had cast, seeming to know there was a hook in it, but thinking there might be a way to get the bait without the hook. Finally, he told Bosch to give him a rundown on the week's investigation. He was on the hook now. Bosch ran the case down for him, and though Pounds never spoke once during the next 20 minutes, Bosch could tell by his roller-coasting eyebrows whenever he heard something that Rourke had neglected to bring up. When the story was finished, there was no more talk from Pounds of Bosch's being withdrawn from the case. Nevertheless, Bosch felt very tired of the whole thing. He wanted to sleep, but Pounds still had questions. If the FBI isn't putting people into the tunnels, should we? He asked. Bosch could see he was thinking in terms of being in on the bust, if there was one. If he put LAPD people into the drainage tunnels, the FBI wouldn't be able to crowd the department out when the credit for the bust came. Pounds would receive a slap on the back from the chief if he could defend against such a maneuver. But Bosch had come to believe that Rourke's reasoning was sound and correct. A tunnel crew would stand a good chance of stumbling into the thieves and maybe getting killed. Now, Bosch told Pounds, let's first see if we can get a fix on Tron and where he keeps his stash. For all we know, it might not even be a bank. Pounds stood up, having heard enough. He said Bosch was free to go. As the lieutenant headed to the interview room door, he said, Bosch, I don't think you'll have any problems with this incident tonight. It sounds to me like you did what you could. The lawyer got his feathers ruffled, but he'll settle down. Or just settle. Bosch didn't say anything or smile at his meager joke. Hey... Yeah. One thing, Pounds continued. The fact that this happened in front of Agent Wish's home is a bit troubling because it has the appearance of impropriety. Just a hint, no? You were just walking her to the door, weren't you? I don't really care how it appeared, Lieutenant, Bosch answered. I was off duty. Pounds looked at Bosch a moment, shook his head as if Bosch had ignored his outstretched hand, and then went through the door of the small room. Bosch found Eleanor sitting by herself in an interview room next to his. Her eyes were closed, and she had her head propped on her hands, her elbows up on the scarred wooden table. Her eyes opened as he walked in. She smiled, and he immediately felt healed of fatigue, frustration, and anger. It was a smile a child gives another when they've gotten away with something on the adults.
All done? She said.
Yeah. You?
Been done more than an hour. You are the one they wanted to grill.
As usual. Rourke has left?
Yeah, he split. Said he wants me to check in with him every other hour tomorrow. After what happened tonight, he thinks he hasn't kept a tight enough rein on this.
Or you.
Yeah. It looks like there is some of that, too. He wanted to know what we were doing at my place. I told him you were just walking me to my door.
Bosch sat down wearily at the other side of the table and dug a finger into a cigarette pack in search of the last one. He put it in his mouth, but didn't light it. Besides being titillated or jealous of what we might have been doing, who does Rourke think tried to take us out? He asked. A drunk driver, like my people seem to think?
He did mention the drunk driver theory. He also asked whether I have a jealous ex-boyfriend. Other than that, there doesn't seem to be a great amount of concern that it might have something to do with our case.
I hadn't thought of the ex-boyfriend angle. What did you tell him?
You're as conniving as he is,
she said, flashing her brilliant smile.
I told him it wasn't any of his business.
Good going. Is it mine?
The answer is no.
She let him hang over the cliff a few seconds, then added,
That is, no jealous ex-boyfriends. So, can we leave now and get to where we were?
She looked at her watch.
About 4 hours ago.
Bosch was awake in Eleanor Wish's bed long before dawn light crept around the curtain drawn across the sliding glass door. Unable to defeat insomnia, he finally got up and took a shower in the downstairs bathroom. After, he looked through her kitchen cabinets and refrigerator and began to put together a breakfast of coffee, eggs, and cinnamon raisin bagels. He couldn't find any bacon. When he heard the shower upstairs go off, he carried a glass of orange juice up and found her in front of the bathroom mirror. She was naked and braiding her hair, which she'd divided into three thick hanks. He was entranced by her and watched as she expertly maneuvered her hair into a French braid. She then accepted the juice and a long kiss from Bosch. She put on her short robe and they went downstairs to eat. After, Harry opened the kitchen door and stood just outside it while he smoked a cigarette. You know, he said, I'm just happy nothing happened.
You mean last night on the street?
Yeah, to you. I don't know how I'd have handled it. I know we just met and all, but... I care, you know?
Me too.
Bosch had taken a shower, but his clothes were as fresh as the ashtray in a used car. After a while, he said he had to leave, to go by his house and change. Eleanor said she would go into the bureau and check for fallout from last night's activities and get whatever was on file about Bin. They agreed to meet at Hollywood Station on Wilcox, because it was closest to Bin's business, and Bosch needed to turn in his damaged car anyway. She walked him to the door, and they kissed as if she were seeing him off to a day at the office at the accounting firm. When Bosch got to his house, he found no messages on the phone machine and no sign that the place had been entered. He shaved and changed clothes and then headed down the hill through Nichols Canyon and then over to Wilcox. He was at his desk, updating the investigating officer's chronological report forms when Eleanor came in at 10. The squad room was full, and most of the detectives who were male stopped what they were doing to check her out. She had an uncomfortable smile on her face when she sat down in the steel chair next to the homicide table. Anything wrong?
I just think I would rather walk through Biscaylo's, she said, referring to the sheriff's jail downtown.
Ah. Yeah, these guys can leer better than most flashers. You want a glass of water?
No, I'm fine. Ready?
Let's do it. They took Bosch's new car, which was actually at least 3 years old and had 77,000 miles on it. The station fleet manager, a permanent desk assignee since he'd had four fingers blown off by a pipe bomb he stupidly picked up one Halloween, said it was the best he could do. Budget restraints had halted the replacement of cars, though repairing the old ones actually cost the department more. At least, Bosch learned after starting the car, the air conditioner worked reasonably well. There was a light Santa Ana condition kicking up, and the forecast was for an unseasonably warm holiday weekend. Eleanor's research on Bin showed he had an office and business on Vermont near Wilshire. There were more Korean-run shops in the area than Vietnamese, but they coexisted. As near as Wish had been able to find out, Bin controlled a number of businesses that imported cheap clothing and electronic and video merchandise from the Orient and then moved it through Southern California and Mexico. Many of the items turistas thought they were getting on the cheap in Mexico and then bringing back to the States had already been there. It all seemed successful on paper, though it was small time. Still, it was enough to make Bosch question if Bin even needed the diamonds, or ever had any. Bin owned the building his office and discount video equipment store was based in. It was a 1930s auto showroom that had been converted years before Bin had ever seen it. Unreinforced concrete block, fronted with wide picture windows, and guaranteed to come down in a decent shaker. But for someone who had made it out of Vietnam the way Bin had, earthquakes were probably viewed as a minor inconvenience, not a risk. After they found an empty parking space across the street from Ben's Electronics, Bosch told Eleanor he wanted her to handle the questioning, at least at first. Bosch said he figured that Bin might be more inclined to talk to the feds than to the locals. They decided on a plan to small-talk him and then ask about Tron. Bosch didn't tell her that he also had a second plan in mind. "Doesn't exactly look like the kind of place run by a guy with a box full of diamonds and a bank vault," Bosch said as they got out of the car.
"That is, had in the bank," she said. "And remember, he couldn't flaunt that stuff. He had to be like every other Joe immigrant, the appearance of living day to day. The diamonds, if there were any, were the collateral for this place, for his American success story. But it had to look like he made it from scratch."
"Wait a second," Bosch said, as they got to the other side of the street. He told Eleanor he had forgotten to ask Jerry Edgar to fill in on a court appearance for him that afternoon. He pointed to a payphone at a service station next to Bin's building and trotted over. Eleanor stayed behind, looking in the windows of the store. Bosch called Edgar, but didn't say anything about a court appearance. "Jed, I need a favor. You won't even have to get up." Edgar hesitated, as Bosch thought he would.
"What do you need?"
"You aren't supposed to say it like that. You're supposed to say, 'Sure, Harry, what do you need?'"
"Come on, Harry, we both know we're under the glass. We've got to be careful. Tell me what you need, I'll tell you if I can do it."
"All I want you to do is buzz me in 10 minutes. I need to get out of a meeting, just buzz me. And when I call in, just put the phone down for a couple minutes. And if I don't call in, buzz me again in 5 minutes. That's it."
"That's all you need, just the buzz."
"Right, 10 minutes from now."
"Okay, Harry. Hey, I heard about your thing last night. That was close. And word around here is that it wasn't no drunk driver. You watch your ass."
"Always. What's going on with Sharky?"
"Nothing. I ran down his crew like you told me. Two of them told me they were with him that night. I think they were rolling faggots. They said they lost sight of him after he got in a car. That was a couple hours before the desk got the call that he was in the tunnel up at the bowl. I figure whoever was in that car did him."
"Description?"
"The car? Not very good. Dark color, American sedan, something new, that's about it."
"What kind of headlights?"
"Well, I showed them the car book, and they picked different taillights. One guy's got round, the other says rectangle, but on the headlights, they both said they..."
"Square, side-by-side squares."
"Right. Hey, Harry, you thinking this is the car that came down on you and the FBI woman? Jesus, we ought to get together on this."
"Later. Maybe later. Meantime, buzz me in 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Right."
Bosch hung up and went back to Eleanor, who was looking through the plate glass window at the ghetto blasters on display. They entered the store, shook off two salesmen, walked around a stack of boxed camcorders on sale for $500 each, and told a woman standing at a cash register station in the back that they were there to see Bin. The woman stared blankly at them until Eleanor showed her badge and federal ID card.
"You wait here,"
the woman said, and then disappeared through a door located behind the cash counter. There was a small, mirrored window in the door that reminded Bosch of the interview room back at Wilcox. He looked at his watch. He had 8 minutes. The man who emerged from the door behind the cash register looked to be about 60 years old. He had white hair. He was short, but Bosch could tell he had once been physically powerful for his size. Built wide and low to the ground, he now was softened by an easier life than he had had in his native land. He wore silver-framed glasses with a pink tint and an open-collar shirt and golf slacks. His breast pocket sagged with the weight of almost a dozen pens and a clip-on pocket flashlight. Ngô Văn Bình was low-key all the way.
"Mr. Bình, my name is Eleanor Wish. I'm from the FBI. This is Detective Bosch, LAPD. We'd like to ask you a few questions."
"Yes?" he said, the stern expression on his face unchanging.
"It's about the break-in at the bank where you had a safe deposit box?"
"I report in Noros. My deposit box had sentimental occupants only."
Diamonds ranked fairly high up there on the sentimental range, Bosch thought.
"Mr. Bin, can we go back to your office and talk privately?"
he said instead.
"Yeah, but I suffer no loss. You look, it ain't in the reports."
Eleanor held her hand out, urging Bin to lead the way. They followed him through the door with the mirror window and into a warehouse-like storage room. There were hundreds of boxes of electronic appliances on steel shelves going to the ceiling. They passed through into a smaller room that was a repair or assembly shop. There was a woman sitting at a tool bench with a bowl of soup held to her mouth. She did not look up as they passed. There were two doors at the back of the shop, and the procession went through one into Bin's office. It was here that Bin shed his peasant trappings. The office was large and plush, with a desk and two chairs to the right and a dark leather L-shaped couch to the left. The couch was at the edge of an oriental rug that featured a three-headed dragon poised to strike. The couch faced two walls of shelves filled by books and stereo and video equipment, much finer than what Bosch had seen out front. "We should have braced him at his home," Bosch thought, "seen how he lived, not how he worked." Bosch quickly scanned the room and saw a white telephone on the desk. It would be perfect. It was an antique, the kind where the handset was cradled above a rotary dial. Bin moved toward his desk, but Bosch quickly spoke up.
"Mr. Bin, would it be okay if we sat over here on the couch? We'd like to keep this as informal as possible. We sit at desks all day, to tell you the truth."
Bin shrugged his shoulders, as though it made no difference to him, that they were inconveniencing him no matter where they sat. It was a distinctly American gesture, and Bosch believed his seeming difficulty with English was a front used to better insulate him. Bin sat down on one side of the L-shaped couch, and Eleanor and Bosch took the other.
"Nice office," Bosch said, and looked around. He saw no other phone in the room.
Bin nodded. He offered no tea or coffee, no small talk. He just said,
"What do you want, please?"
Bosch looked at Eleanor. She said,
"Mr. Bin, we are just retracing our steps. You reported no financial loss in the vault break-in.
That is right, no loss."
"That is correct. What did you keep in the box?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Paper and such, no value. I told this to everyone already."
"Yes, we know. We're sorry to bother you again. But the case remains open, and we have to go back and see if we missed anything. Could you tell me, in specific detail, what papers you lost? It might help us if we make a recovery of property and can identify who it belongs to."
Eleanor took a small notebook and pen out of her purse. Bin looked at his two visitors as if he could not possibly see how this information could help. Bosch said,
"You'd be surprised sometimes what little things can..."
His pager tone sounded, and Bosch pulled the device off his belt and looked at the number display. He stood up and looked around as if he was just noticing the room for the first time. He wondered if he was overdoing it.
"Mr. Bin, can I use your phone? It'll be local."
Bin nodded, and Bosch walked to the front of the desk, leaned over, and picked up the handset. He made a show of checking the pager number again, then dialed Edgar's number. He remained standing with his back to Eleanor and Bin. He looked up at the wall, as if studying the silk tapestry that hung there. He heard Bin begin to describe to Eleanor the immigration and citizenship papers that had been taken from his safe deposit box. Bosch put the pager in his coat pocket and came out with the small pocket knife, the T9 phone bug, and the small battery he had disconnected from his own phone. This is Bosch.